From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, despite that messed up rollout, Texans are signing up for the Affordable Care Act.
We have the most at stake with the highest number of uninsured.
The political primary matchups are set, and there are some shockers.
Senator Cruz is enormously popular among Republican primary voters. He's also taken very much as a serious person among Republican primary voters. I'm not sure that's the case with Steve Stockman.
And the family secrets of making the perfect Christmas tamales. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texans like hearing about how wonderful and exceptional our state is, but a recent ranking of states based on health has the Lone Star State in less than a mediocre position. Dr. Harvey Balthaser is the South Texas Medical Director for United Healthcare.
This year, Texas is 36. Last year, we were 35. Bottom is 50. The number one is the top. We're just about where we had been, which is not the direction we want to be going. We're down just a little bit, and we're not making the changes we need to improve the way we want to and get up with the top-ranked states. Like Hawaii, which is number one this year, Vermont is number two, and Minnesota's third.
So Texas slipping, not improving health-wise. And what are some of the factors that you guys looked at in determining that?
So the number of people are overweight, have conditions like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. They're not getting the care they need because 26% of folks in Texas don't have access to health insurance, and if you don't have health insurance, it's hard to be able to pay for the medical care you need and to get the preventative services that you need.
So Texas, we rank top in the nation, number one for the people without health insurance. Also, we saw a 12% decline last year in children's immunizations. And, of course, we saw some budget cuts to that program here in Texas last year.
That's correct.
So that's pretty critical.
That's absolutely critical. I'm a pediatrician by training, and so children's health care is near and dear to my heart. And if we're not taking care of those most at risk are young people. They're not going to develop in the way they need to. They're not going to be able to participate in school and in sports and become healthy tax-paying Texans.
That is a cheap, quick fix for a problem that could cause a lot of suffering and expense later down the line. Also, we're drilling down deeper on the numbers, looking at Texas county by county, which is how y'all have broken down these rankings. You see that there are some clusters of areas that really do need some help, particularly in East Texas. That's where we see many of the most unhealthy counties in the state.
That's correct. And the Rio Grande Valley also has some challenges, too.
I was surprised to see in the county rankings that there were some counties in the border that did well. They were in the top third.
Don't get me wrong. I think there's a lot of improvement in the valley, but it's still an area where people don't have as well-paying jobs. They may have grown up without access to good health care, not eating the right things, not getting the right exercise. And those are all forerunners of chronic diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure.
Now, but Polk County, which came in dead last in the rankings for Texas, that's in East Texas, and we're seeing all of the risk factors way up high for the folks who live out there.
Agreed. They don't have as much access to good health care there. Many of the people live in Polk County don't have quite the access to good jobs or good pay, and so again, they can't pay for their health care, they can't pay for good food, they may not be living in the best of circumstances, and their health status depends on all of those things.
A high teen birth rate, high smoking rate, high obesity rate, lots of those issues. Those are pointers of not living healthy lifestyles.
Absolutely.
So how does this information get used? How can we turn things around?
Well, I hope that making this information more available and getting it out in front of the public, in front of our legislators, that there's going to be a lot more emphasis on developing better programs so that people, particularly children, can get better access to health care, can get better access to good food, and get better control of their weight, get tested early in life if they have incidents of diabetes, and because we all know that being overweight is a setup for being a diabetic, and there are more and more adolescents and even pre-adolescent children who are overweight, who are becoming diabetic very early in life. And it's a slippery slope from diabetes to diseases like chronic kidney disease and chronic blood pressure problems.
Dr. Harvey Balthaser is the South Texas Medical Director for UnitedHealthcare. As we mentioned, one of the big indicators of public health is health insurance, and Texas might do better in the rankings next year because more people in Texas have purchased health plans through the Obamacare online insurance marketplace than in any other state. That's according to the enrollment figures for October and November, released Wednesday by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But when you look at this as a percentage of the uninsured, that number is tiny. That's because so many Texans are without health insurance. Nevertheless, many are encouraged that Texans are signing up, given the political climate in the state against the ACA. John Hawkins is the Vice President of Public Policy for the Texas Hospital Association.
We hope for better performance than we've had so far. We are seeing some uptick in the enrollment numbers, and I think that's positive. Hopefully, as more folks become familiar with what's out there, as the website becomes more operational, we'll see a greater take-up rate.
What are the numbers telling us?
Preliminary numbers from Department of Health and Human Services. Basically, they say more than 14,000 Texans have enrolled in plans.
That's up from fewer than 3,000 of last month, when they had the terrible rollout of the website and it just wasn't really working for them. People were not able to sign up. Now that the website is working a lot better, we're seeing that Texans are enrolling in plans, 14,000. Of course, Texas has the highest number of uninsured in the country, and still there's a lot more to go if this is going to work.
Yeah, I think, again, we have the most at stake with the highest number of uninsured, more than 5 million uninsured. So I think, our projection is to get 1.5 million or so covered under the exchanges, and then hopefully the state will revisit the decision to expand Medicaid, because we were looking for about another 1.7 million to be covered through Medicaid expansion. So it's important that we maximize coverage under these exchanges.
And for the deadlines that people are dealing with is that there is a December 23rd deadline if they want to sign up in time to get insurance through the marketplace by the start of the year. But they can still, the window is open to sign up for the Affordable Care Act until March 31st.
Correct. I think it's just an issue of obviously there has to be a deadline for the health plans to actually get the coverage started, get the paperwork done, kind of the behind-the-scenes work done. So there will be a rolling enrollment period, if you will, but there are some hard and fast deadlines just from a processing standpoint.
So you mentioned the lack of the expansion of Medicaid in Texas, and that, of course, is something that's going to cost the state billions of dollars, and that is certainly going to hurt Texas hospitals because you guys provide a lot of care to people who come into the emergency room, and if they don't have insurance, they don't have means, they can't be turned away.
Correct. We're providing about, Texas hospitals are providing about $5 billion a year in uncompensated care right now. That cost is getting shifted onto the private market. Additionally, we're taking about $13 billion in cuts to help finance the Affordable Care Act. That's over a 10-year period. And again, the idea was you would make you would offset those losses with payments for folks that were previously uninsured. So, you know, we've got to get that back through coverage to the exchanges, and then half of that was to come through Medicaid expansion, which the state has decided not to do at this point.
So the way that works is that the Medicaid expansion, these are the people that are too poor even to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. They're too poor for Obamacare. And there were rules put into the Affordable Care Act, as it was written, about hospitals and the type of care that they would provide to people. And the assumption was that all states would have this expansion of Medicaid, and then that would provide the funding for those new rules of the services that y'all would provide.
Correct. And again, you know, I think the ideally you want a private market solution, and really that's where the exchanges come into place. And the reality is, and particularly for the working poor, the premium is too high. So, you know, that's why you want to, if you can, provide subsidy. And again, from the hospital standpoint, it was worth us to take payment cuts to help finance that subsidy in the private market. Now, the act recognized that folks that at too low of an income wouldn't even be able to afford any premium, and so that's why the default was Medicaid expansion. But even with that said, some states like Arkansas have looked at ways of doing the Medicaid expansion in the private market with just a nominal patient participation copay or a small deductible.
So there is a third way, if the state leaders were willing to take another look at expanding Medicaid, then they could do so without embracing with the program that they think is that they say is broken.
Correct. And again, you know, those are state dollars, payment cuts and taxes that are already accruing in D.C. In other states, Arkansas, Pennsylvania, Iowa, have looked at alternatives ways to go after that federal funding, but do so not in straight entitlement expansion, but more as a private market solution.
John Hawkins is the Vice President of Public Policy for the Texas Hospital Association. The deadline to sign up for a primary election has passed in Texas, and we now know who will face who for their party's nomination. And as you would expect, most of the action in Texas is with the ruling Republican Party. The matchup that nabbed the most newspaper ink was Tea Party Congressman Steve Stockman's surprising challenge to conservative Senator John Cornyn. We turn to Quorum Report's editor Harvey Kronberg for his analysis.
Nobody thinks that it's currently workable unless he can get into a runoff. Runoff dynamics are dramatically different, but he only has a couple of months to try and put together a statewide organization. He does not have very much money, and frankly, most people believe that one of the reasons he decided to enter this race was because Speaker Boehner was so upset with him that they were going to finance a challenger. So it wasn't even clear he could win his own district, much less win a statewide race.
But we heard all this stuff about Ted Cruz. You know, Ted Cruz was able to go to the right of David Dewhurst and become a U.S. senator from Texas. Why not Stockman? He certainly
Well, there were multiple differences. One is that Ted Cruz spent 2 years on the road campaigning for something. Originally, it was going to be for attorney general, and then it was ultimately the best target of opportunity was the Senate seat. Second, the primary was delayed 2 months because of all the redistricting litigation that was going on, and the runoff was actually in the middle of the summer, all that played to Cruz's advantage. In a normal 9-week primary cycle, he who has the most money and can dominate television usually will prevail, but all of those things were not the case in the Cruz-Dewhurst race.
But is Cornyn, is he going to be running hard and running scared?
Well, it's an interesting moment for the Republican Party because, as we all know, there's been a battle between the establishment and the Tea Party conservatives. And while Senator Cruz is enormously popular among Republican primary voters, he's also taken very much as a serious person among Republican primary voters. I'm not sure that's the case with Steve Stockman. He's going to be a magnet for a certain group, certain subtext of Republican primary voters. But I think that Cornyn is well known. He's taken care of business. Nobody really doubts his conservative credentials, although they may argue about the order of magnitude. I think he's going to have to take it very seriously. But unless there is an enormous amount of Washington money to give Steve Stockman a very big microphone, it's very hard to see how he can get there.
Well, that Washington money doesn't appear to be coming because Club for Growth said that they do not support Congressman Stockman's run for Senate.
That's correct. And
and people are seeing that as a big move, that they have gone too far to the right, even for the Club for Growth.
They've got bigger target. These folks are engaged in trying to take out the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, and they have dried up some of their own fundraising ability by creating essentially what's a civil war inside the Republican Party. You only pick the battles that you've got a chance to win, and this one's just too remote.
So where else across Texas were we seeing a Tea Party candidates trying to outright some of our established politicians?
Well, we've got about 12 or 13 House races where the Republican Civil War is in full swing. And you've got Tea Party types. But my sense, frankly, is, well, there's two things, and this is a little bit counterintuitive. But first of all, I tend to think that Stockman on the ticket is going to galvanize establishment Republicans to turn out and is going to have a very different reaction than most folks think, because this is a traditional primary. It's essentially less than 12 weeks away, Cornyn is very well regarded by the business community, and they've been taken by surprise once. I'm not sure they're going to allow themselves to be taken by surprise again. And so my suspicion is that that Tea Party types are going to be more on defense this election than they were last election. The second really interesting thing to me is that when you look at the folks that are challenging incumbent Tea Party types, particularly in the Texas House, you find a large number of school board members and city council members and mayors and folks very well known in their community, considered solid conservatives, but also who have been in the trenches solving problems for their communities. And so whereas in 2010 and 2012 you could nationalize the election about Barack Obama, I'm not sure that is going to be as effective in the Republican primary this time.
In West Texas, Congressman Neugebauer is being challenged by a Tea Partier, Dr. Donald May, who is
correct,
known as
Mr. Conservative.
Mr. Conservative. I've enjoyed reading his columns in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal.
Yes.
The comments to the column are even more entertaining. Is that emblematic of what's happening?
It's emblematic, but it's not as pervasive as you might think. As we look at this list of candidates, most of these challengers are fairly symbolic. Now, in this particular case, against Neugebauer, this fellow has had a platform and a microphone now for several years.
Yeah, his columns have headlines like "Obamacare is Marxism," "Conservatives are winning." You know, just very catchy headlines.
Yes. Yes, they make a certain legitimate case in that Neugebauer has never offered any kind of legislation that, in theory, would benefit the agricultural interests of the folks out there. But that's also counterproductive because Tea Party folks argue they don't want government or federal assistance. That might be an exception as far as congressional races go. And Pete Sessions.
Yeah, he's being challenged by a staffer for Ted Cruz.
Correct. And in the Metroplex, there is an infrastructure. So those are probably the two most interesting races to look at, at least in terms of Congress, as a possible Tea Party upset.
Harvey Kronberg is the editor of The Quorum Report, an impartial online newsletter that covers Texas politics. It's at quorumreport.com. For many in Texas, tamales are a big part of the Christmas tradition, as big as eggnog, caroling, and fruitcake. And it's not just the consumption of the corn husk morsels that make it Christmas, it's also the family's endeavor to make them. TPR's contributor Yvette Benavides explains the 16 items that are essential to making the perfect Christmas tamale.
Number one, the first step in this whole process is vacillation, indecision. Will we or won't we? Will we forgo making tamales this year and just buy them because the process is so strenuous and stressful and very tiring? Inevitably, someone dares to say out loud, "Yeah, let's not make them this year." After a few days, no one seems to remember that impulsive agreement, and we set the date to meet for the yearly tamalada. Most times, the decision to make them revolves around the promise of a visit from a sibling who lives out of state. Other times, it comes from the fact that my mom has venison in the freezer. Number two, on the day of the tamalada, start early, preferably before the sun comes up. Drink half of your morning coffee and put the cup in the microwave for later. Head out to the molino on the fringes of the west side or south side of your city. Your GPS will be useless, and you might find that the molino has moved locations two or three times in the last year since the last time you were there. When you find the place, you will discover that the proprietor and everyone who works there is male. Ranchera music will emanate from the back room, as will the motor sounds of the molino itself, churning out the masa that you need. Never get the masa preparada. Always buy masa pa tortilla, because you will spend the next few hours at home preparing it yourself. You'll be tempted to ask for just 5 pounds, 10 at the most, because you want to get done early in the day and relax. But you'll end up asking for 20 pounds and pray that your mom, who asked you to get 25 pounds, won't look at you like you've come home with a handful of magic beans. Number three, once home, put on your faded sweats and the apron you don't wear at any other time of the year. Pull out the bandana from your sock drawer and put it on. If you don't, you'll need a hairnet. Step four, press 60 seconds on the microwave to warm up your half cup of coffee. In the next minute, swept up by the work, you will not remember or even have time to drink it. You will find the cup in the microwave the next day when you go to reheat a tepid tamal. 5. Prepare all ingredients. Everything but everything is from scratch. You will not be able to cheat with jarred pre-chopped garlic. You will not be able to pour in a smidgen of chili powder or ground cumin. Get out that molcajete. You will need ancho and guajillo peppers. Be prepared to use lard or shortening for the first time all year since the last time you made tamales. 6. Only one person is allowed to touch the masa while it's being prepared for the tamales. A second pair of hands will taint the masa and ruin everyone's Christmas. In the event that the main masa mom is not able to fulfill her masando duties, you will have to step in. You will realize that this is not work for the hands, but for the core. You will breathe heavily. You won't even be self-conscious about it. You will just keep going with the CPR because this is not a relay and no other hands can touch the stuff and taint it and ruin everyone's Christmas. You must finish what you started. Your bandana will absorb your perspiration. 7. The water test must be performed. This is akin to the wall test for spaghetti. Although the tamal test is different, often masa does end up on the wall, and the floor, and the cat, and somehow on the Christmas tree in the living room. When you think it's ready, put a dollop of masa in a glass of room temperature water. If it floats, it's ready. If it doesn't float, it's not ready. Don't be tempted to proceed until it floats, or you will single-handedly ruin everyone's Christmas celebration and their New Year. 8. At some point in the last couple of hours, someone turned off the radio and stopped the din of the 24-hour Christmas music station. Turn the radio back on. Later on, someone else will turn it off during the umpteenth playing of Holly Jolly Christmas and will turn on the small TV on the counter. There won't be much to watch because Mom doesn't have cable on in the kitchen TV. The volume will be muted most of the day, but you'll still be able to look up from tying the thread of corn husk to the tamales that have chile to see folks wrestling after paternity test results are revealed and dirty laundry exposed on morning television. Later, you'll notice that afternoon television has the same programming. 9. Select your spoon from the silverware drawer. You will become one with the spoon in the next several hours. This will become your best friend. If your spoon gets mixed up with someone else's, you will know it as soon as you pick it up. It will feel different. You can tell. Your spoon is the only spoon you can possibly use if you're going to stay in this assembly line. 10. Everyone is supposed to have one job in the tamale-making process, but be prepared to pinch hit if needed. You might have to be in charge of soaking the corn husks or spreading the masa or filling the tamales with meat or beans. You might be in charge of slicing the rajas of jalapeño. You might be in charge of writing out the labels for the storage bags or of counting out 2 dozen per bag, bagging them, and venturing out to store them in your mom's freezer in the back porch. Just don't stick your hands in the masa if that is someone else's job. 11. After the first dozen tamales are ready, it's time to stop and cook up a batch to see how they taste. Make sure the taste and texture are just right. You can try to make your escape now for this one and only lull in the frenetic pace of the work. But you shouldn't, because you'll miss out on tasting the first tamales of the season. This would be a huge loss. Epic. When you taste them, you will find the strength to go on for 10 more hours of tamalada. 12. Fact. The first tamal is the best one you'll eat all year. 13. The novice move is undercooking tamales because you just can't wait to eat them. Another novice move is to fear undercooking them and letting the water that turns to vapor to cook the tamales boil down and evaporate to nothing and leave the lingering smell of burned beans in the air until after the new year. 14. After the tamale tasting, do not adjust the salt or the comino to taste. Everyone except Mom will agree that the tamales are perfect, and they will mean it. Mom will insist for the next year that les faltó algo, they need something, and you will never convince her that they are perfect, the best ever. 15. Taste test is over. Now it's time to get back to work. In tamale making, there are sitters and standers, but you should prepare to stand for most of the next several hours as you and your loved ones continue to make hundreds and hundreds of tamales. Worry that your dowager's hump is growing by the second. The back of your neck is going to hurt for hours and hours. Your feet will hurt, your legs, even your butt if you're a sitter. Feel the burn. This is for tamales. It's worth it. And 16. You may enjoy the zen of tamale making. It can be a lonely office, even in a room full of people. But resist going into that place in your head just for today. Join in the conversation, the chisme, the singing, the laughter, and the tears. At no other time except for weddings and funerals will this same group of loved ones convene. Tamale making is in no way as stressful as the former or as sad as the latter. It's the only collaboration I can think of that requires a whole day of togetherness. You could be weaving baskets or painting model airplanes, but you are making tamales, a delicious traditional meal that you can share with others all year long. Every time you open the freezer for anything else, for ice cubes or ice cream or frozen veggies, you'll see the bags of tamales there piled high. You'll note your mother's distinctive handwriting on the labels, frijol con chile or carne with raisins, and you will feel a nameless emotion that takes the breath right out of your body. Your heart will ache a little, and you'll always remember the day and all the other December days you spent together making tamales.
Yvette Benavides is a writer and contributor to Texas Matters. She will be making tamales again this Christmas with her family in Laredo. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening. You can write to Texas Matters with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can also write directly on our website at tpr.org. And that's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.